From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's Friday, and that means we begin with our week in review. We'll talk about what's been happening in Rockford, DeKalb, and Northern Illinois in a few minutes, and we'll get to politics after that. But first, we're going to spend some time today on a big story from our neighboring state of Missouri. That is where, on Tuesday, a government official delivered a fatal dose of a chemical, ending the life of Marcellus Williams. Williams had been convicted of the 1998 murder of Felicia Gale. She had spent her early years in Rockford, Illinois, gotten a journalism degree at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and she was working as a reporter at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch when someone broke into her home and ended up stabbing her 43 times. The case got national attention as questions were raised about the evidence used to convict Williams. Just days prior to his execution, Williams and his attorneys filed multiple court appeals to try to stop it, and so did the prosecuting office that originally convicted him. But all those were unsuccessful. Joining us now to talk more about this is Dana Reek, a courts reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Dana, thank you for making the time to be with us today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Can you briefly tell us about more about the circumstances of the 1998 murder for which Williams was convicted?
Sure. So her husband, Felicia Gale's husband, Dr. Daniel Pikus, came home one night in August of 1998 and found her in the hallway. As you mentioned, she had been stabbed 43 times, and there was the kitchen was in disarray. Police began to investigate. It was clear to them that someone had broken in. There was a broken window in the front door area. It took about a year, though, for their first lead in the case, and that is when a man who was released from jail, his name is Henry Cole, went to police and said that his cellmate, Marcellus Williams, had confessed to the murder. And that is when police began investigating Williams. He was convicted in 2001, largely on the testimony of Henry Cole, the cellmate, as well as his ex-girlfriend, who said that he had also told her that he had killed Felicia Gale and had some had witnessed him pawning off Ms. Gale's laptop that he took from the home. So he's convicted in 2001.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, you're fine. He's convicted in 2001 by a jury of 11 white people and one black person. They then deliberate for about 90 minutes and sentence him to death.
So you mentioned that this was sort of informant testimony and his girlfriend's testimony. Informant testimony, experts say, is particularly proven to be unreliable in some of these cases. Was there physical evidence or any other evidence linking him to this murder?
That's actually an interesting point, and I think one that a lot of people who believe he's innocent will point to. There is no DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence linking him to the crime scene. What they do have is a Post-Dispatch ruler that was used for measuring print prior to computers, as well as the laptop. Now, he sold that to a man who lived a few doors down from Williams' grandfather. However, in trial, this man was not allowed to testify that Marcellus Williams had told him he had received the computer from his girlfriend before pawning it to this man.
So you mentioned the, okay, so there's no, that's not necessarily physical evidence. I understand the murder weapon had been apparently contaminated as well over the years, which is one of the problems you have sometimes with revisiting these cases decades after the original trial.
Correct. And that's kind of when this case this year sort of unraveled. So our St. Louis County prosecuting attorney, Wesley Bell's office, filed a motion to vacate his conviction in January, arguing that he was innocent because the knife used to kill Felicia Gale had two unknown DNA profiles on it, and neither one matched Marcellus. The lawyers filed the motion, arguing that that proved his innocence and that the DNA on that knife actually belonged to the killer. Go for it.
Well, I would say, so I think you raised an interesting point there and one I think we should dwell on for a moment. It was the prosecuting, maybe we should take a step back. So we'll get to the point where the prosecutor actually tries to reopen this case. There had been previous appeals. What is the sort of legal history of this case where you know, any capital case, there are going to be multiple rounds of appeals and attempts to get it overturned. Obviously, all those were unsuccessful up till now. Is there sort of a big picture that emerged from those past attempts, though?
I think the biggest picture that emerged was that Marcellus Williams maintained his innocence up through his execution. They've taken several claims to various appeals courts all the way up through the Missouri Supreme Court. One is concerns about illegally, the trial prosecutor illegally striking a potential juror because of his race. He was a young black man who in August that trial prosecutor said, you know, looked like Marcellus Williams, which is one of the big reasons that he struck it. That claim was never, you know, that claim was denied by multiple courts, and then eventually the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear Marcellus Williams' case.
So talk more about Wesley Bell, and maybe for our listeners who are not as familiar with St. Louis politics, who he is and what his role has been in the prosecutor's office role in trying to revisit this case.
Sure. So Wesley Bell is a progressive prosecutor. He sort of rose up through the Ferguson unrest, much like Cori Bush did. And when he was elected to the prosecuting attorney's office, he really ran on progressive platforms and was looking for more rehabilitation efforts rather than just punishment. Obviously, there's some racial disparities in criminal law that he was hoping to address. And more recently, your listeners have probably heard about him because he just ousted Cori Bush in our Democratic primary for her seat in Congress.
And so and what was his big argument again for revisiting this case? You mentioned the weapon did not have evidence apparently linking it to Mr. Williams.
Sure. So yeah, the motion in January argued that because those two unknown DNA profiles did not match Marcellus Williams' DNA, that proves that he was innocent of the murder and that the DNA would likely lead prosecutors and authorities to the actual killer. On the eve of the August evidence hearing, where Wesley Bell's office, along with Marcellus Williams' attorneys, were set to argue this, they received DNA results back from a test they had commissioned that indicated that one of the DNA profiles was consistent with the trial prosecutor, Keith Larner, and the other one could be a match to a criminal investigator on the case at the time, Ed McGee. Both men readily admit that they handled the knife before Marcellus Williams' trial without gloves.
Hmm.
So that essentially rendered the evidence moot, and their argument really was shattered after that.
Well, anything else that would develop here would obviously come too late for Williams. And this is not the first time somebody would have been executed with at least some questions about, you know, the guilt, I guess you would say, in this case. Did you hear anything from the advocates for Mr. Williams that they'll continue trying to investigate, or does this story end here?
You know, the main issue with the case at this point is the two main witnesses who did provide testimony during the original criminal trial have since died. Both of their families have signed affidavits, according to Wesley Bell's office, saying that they were sort of known for lying to police to get what they wanted. They both had drug abuse issues, and there was some reward money that was called into question as well. But as far as proving his innocence or his guilt at this point, now that he's been executed, I don't know where that effort goes from here.
Yeah. Well, Dana Reek with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, thank you for sharing your reporting with us. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much.
And we're going to turn now to Maria Gardner-Lara, who's a reporter with our partner station, WNIJ, Northern Public Radio, to talk about some stories that have happened in Rockford and DeKalb this week. Maria, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks, Brian, for having me.
I want to start with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and we have to move kind of quickly today. We only have about 6 minutes left before the break, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced it was awarding funds for farm and meatpacking workers who were left out from stimulus checks during the pandemic. How much are people getting, and who's expected to benefit from this?
Yeah, so folks will be receiving if applied and approved, they would be receiving $600 via a Visa card, so like a gift card. And this would be available for farm workers, meatpacking workers who worked at some point during the pandemic and were excluded from COVID relief payments. So it was about 3,000 in total. And then there were, you know, there was also tax breaks that folks got depending on how many children under them. So this is one way to remedy the fact that, you know, there was a group of folks that were that did not get those checks. And one of the reasons why they may not have, you know, there's various reasons why they may not have qualified, but one of the big reasons is, you know, folks who were undocumented. So these are workers, essential workers doing, again, meatpacking, working at slaughterhouses, farm workers, and they may have, you know, one of the things we note in the story is they may have American children. Regardless, they were not included in those COVID checks. And so this is one way that the government is recognizing that these folks were contributed to our recovery and providing some form of relief, whether it's not much, but it's certainly a recognition that they were here, that they contributed to our recovery.
As I recall, meatpacking was a pretty dangerous place to be during the pandemic as well. There were some outbreaks at meatpacking plants.
Yeah. So we highlight in the story, right, is that there was a big effort by the meatpacking industry to say, hey, we got to keep going. We don't want any pause here. And so they've done studies. They found that in areas where, you know, you look at the top five meatpacking players in communities where there were meatpackings, there was definitely high number of COVID cases, of deaths. And so, yeah, they were hit pretty hard. Whereas other industries could shut down, they kept going. And so, yeah, definitely meatpacking folks were hit hard. And so this is a way of recognizing them, you know, and, you know, you could argue that it's not much, that it may be, it's pretty late in the game, but it's something. And so folks, you know, the money is limited, and they don't have that much. The window is also short, so they're expecting to run out of funds by the end of October.
So people need to move fast. All right. One other story I wanted to ask you about that you've been reporting on is more and more international students are choosing Illinois public universities for their graduate education. How has Northern Illinois University fared in that regard?
Yeah, so it's an area that's growing, and they've done a lot of you know, they're leading in that area. It's something that they've already put a lot of attention to. And so in particular in students coming from India, from Nigeria, from parts of Africa. And so it's growing. And, you know, it helps in a way in some cases, because, you know, these are students who pay, you know, they contribute significantly more to, you know, in the tuition than other folks. So, you know, it helps in the bottom line for the university. And so, yeah, they've definitely are leading in ahead of the curve in other places in terms of their outreach to students.
Yeah.
International students.
And I said you're reporting. My mistake. I should have said that was your colleague, Peter Medlin, who was reporting on that story. And thank you for sharing.
Oh, yes. Right. Peter Medlin. Right. He's our education reporter. Right.
Absolutely.
No, that wasn't mine. Right.
So I do want to ask you also, and we only got about a minute and a half left, but a resident of Sandwich, Illinois, has been busy this month partaking in Hispanic Heritage Month festivities across the city. How did you get put on this story, and how has she been celebrating?
Yeah, so what's great, Sandwich, Illinois, which is, by the way, where Peter Medlin, our education reporter, is from, it's when we think of Latino communities, Hispanic communities, we may think of big urban spaces like Chicago or Rockford, but also in these rural areas, you know, the Latino community is growing, and this is one example of that. You know, Sandwich is a town about 7,000, 1,000 of folks are of Latino descent, and so they're also celebrating in their own way. And so she has a gift for song, and she's singing, and she is going. You know, there's different events where she's been asked to participate. So Plano had the Hispanic the Chamber of Commerce there of Plano had an event that she performed at. There was an event in DeKalb, where the local Catholic Church was having a celebration. She participated in that, and so you know, folks are busy. There may not be fireworks and a big show like in Chicago, but certainly people have pride in and are proud of the contributions they made here and are taking forth and taking part in celebrations.
Maria Gardner Lara is a reporter with WNIJ Northern Public Radio. Thank you for being with us to share your and your colleagues' reporting with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be turning to politics with Linda Kenyon, our Washington reporter. We'll also hear a story out of Illinois about voter information that was put out there as a result of a data breach in dozens of counties across the state. And then sports. Yes, sports. All that's coming up here on the 21st Show. Stay with us.